came from the from Vancouver, and he went in there and went down the riverways and came back. He had an idea of mining on the Stewart, which he did. That was the thing to do in the in the 90s. Pardon my talked a bunch of it. And he was liked it there, but he got up as far as went up the Question River, which is a branch, North Branch. And he climbed the Lookout Mountain. And it's supposed to be, in my mind, it's around 93. And then he, I think we'd better keep it up. Well, I think I left Andy up on climbing up Lookout Mountain with his, he went up the north side, that was quite steep from the Question River where he left his boat. He went, looked over the country there to see where he could go, and he decided he would go back down again, down the river. He was above the jam, yeah. He was above the jam on the Question there. And he picked up some pieces of galena there as he went down the one of those steep creeks. Now, I'm not sure the name of it now, what they call it. Steep Creek. I don't think it was Steep Creek, but I'm not sure. And he was... took this sapple in, down in the boat, and we returned to Stewart River, and there he met people going to 40 Mile. There was quite a little activity down 40 Mile in all those days, and that's where he went back that way. But he decided not to not to go that way. It was getting late in the summer, and he wanted to go back to what's that northern B.C. there place? Cassiar, yeah, the Cassiar. He was going to winter there. That's where he'd been before. And he decided to look it on the map that he could just walk right over there. He'd do it. So he went up the Yukon, and I think he said he went up the Teslin or the... or some other stream, a little salmon, big salmon or something, and cut across, walked right across. He had a couple of pack dogs and a gun, and he was used to that sort of thing. Well, it was in the summertime. It was, I think it was after long about September, I think it was, right about August or something that he started up. He had, of course, pole up to there from about the Stewart. But he met this man there, very interested in silver ore, and he took the specimens with him, so he doesn't know how it turned out. He never did hear. But the man told him what it was, and it had a possibility for silver, but of course, silver in those days in the Yukon was, of course, just like lead or anything else. Lead in our time up there. Nowadays, quite an interesting thing.
Actually, that's the first discovery of silver you've ever heard of.
That's the only one I first ever heard of, yes. Nobody had any... but Andy, he went on through that time, and he's found some very nice, he spoke about the copper. The copper inflamed his mind there in northern B.C., you know, but he was down to, he went across there somewhere probably above the canyon on the Liard, but I don't know just exactly where, and headed on down to, went into Cassiar business. And I don't... he didn't know, he couldn't tell on the map just where he was. He kept walking south. And pretty terribly tough trip, and he took himself a bunch. Got pretty late before he got down Cassie Iron got in there. And he found a lot of nice streaks of copper ore. He always wanted to go back there, but he never did it. And I, Andy came back after he came back, and he came to Mayo. Well, he came back into Dawson, I think, at the gold rush. I think he came back with the gold rush and was around there. But he came back up to Mayo eventually and was living there. He had been coal mining. He was coal mining experience on the coast down there at where the mine was called Vancouver Island. So that was his background. He was really a miner.
Well, didn't he start out as a sailor?
Well, yes, a sailor from Sweden, but he got a lot of experience in the coal mining business, working around Vancouver Island before the days that he went. No, that was long, probably in the 80s or sometime.
Did he discover something around Mayo afterwards?
Well, then, when we came, we went up there in 1990. Well, I met Andy. He had been prospecting over at Lookout Mountain there and had this prospect, which was later developed by Pickering and company. And he took me over there the famous winter of 1917-18 there, when it was got averaged down into the 70s or 60s, the average 64, I figured, that winter there at Mayo for a month. And we went over there during a very cold spell, kind of a break in the cold spell, because I had to stay at Middle Bridge there, and I got tired of staying there for week after week, you know. We went over to the, and saw the, his prospect. That is being developed now. I got a letter about it from, Dr. Aho. And I thought it looked kind of interesting. That's what got Pickering interested. Pickering was up there with me. Then that's the first I got acquainted with Andy, and he told me all his experiences there and different things he did. And, the next year, I went up there to the stake the Keno set up on top of Keno Hill, Andy heard that we had gone up there with Bavette, and so he rushed up quick and staked a place that he had found while hunting on when he was working over around Duncan Creek, that Sardo Hill, the present known as Sardo Hill. In fact, he named it Sardo Hill. He staked a number of claims on that there, sort of. He's afraid maybe that's where Louis had found this ore, you see, until he found out different. And he mined there along about 1925 or something like that, or a little early, I don't know just when it was there. He mined there, and he took out quite a good shipments out of the one baby found. Still, I don't think anybody has prospected those places too thoroughly. Yes. They work there, but they don't. Then, that was all about Andy. He stayed around there till he died, and I don't know. I can't remember just when he died. Yeah, he had a cabin at Middle Bridge.
When did you hit Dawson?
I went to Dawson in the spring of 1911. I was sent up there by the Selby Smelting Company here in the Bay. And I went up there to melt the gold, get it in shape to send it down to the Selby Smelter. Stanford manager was the manager there was a Stanford graduate, and a lot of them up there, engineers were, and so we felt right at home. I knew the people, some of them, before they were here. so they were up there. And manager's wife was her mother was my wife's Sunday school teacher in Santa Barbara and so forth, so I even felt kind of home-like with all of those people, you know. I stayed there from then until 1921, went up to Mayo. And then from Mayo I stayed till 1941, and that was the end of it.
Well, you said you were up in
1917,
too, right?
Yes. I was living in Dawson, you know, in the wintertime, as the placer mining is a big dredging company with 7 dredges, and their business was mostly engineering and preparatory work for their next season's operations, of course. And I got to do the job of being an assayer. I could go and get out and see some of the prospects. And Tom, Tom Aiken had opened up the Silver King about 1912, and he was around there for a year or two, in and out, and Banji used to go up there once in a while. He went away, so in 1917 I was sent up there. And I looked over the place around to see what new was, and went over to Mount Cameron and Jack Alberson took me around too, as well as Andy. I looked up. Dawson then for 10 years, during which time I came out once or twice until I was married in 1912. Then I went in 1913 and stayed in, and then First World War came on and upset the mining industry as usual, so that mining was carried on, but it wasn't didn't thrive like it had, and I went traveling around looking for some nice hard rock prospects wherever I could think of anything to see, and prospecting around in the winter time, which of course isn't the best time of year to go. And we moved up to Dawson, left Dawson. I left Dawson in 1919, wasn't really there much of any afterwards. And family moved up to Mayo in 1921. We stayed there till 1941, but the family came out in 1928 in order to cope with the school situation. And let's see, what was it we were going to see? Yeah, Louis Babette, he was an old timer there, and he discovered this while hunting up on top of Keno Hill. He discovered the bit of galena down there over the bank, what we call number one vein. It didn't actually turn out to be very heavily mineralized, but it was a nice little streak down there. I don't think that the present company has gone down there yet. In that connected, I haven't seen anything mentioned about it. And then took the ore down to the river, down to Mayo, and Pickering was up there. Pickering was then doing some plating for some of the placer miners, and he contracted the plating for Tom Aiken at the Silver King mine. It was quite a bought man around the mining areas there, and he came right back down to Dawson, bought me the samples, and we assayed them and saw they were very good. 200 or 300 ounces, good specimens were. And so decided, management decided they better go right up there and look at the thing. Well, of course, we did. We went up with a launch, the Hazel B. Was it? No, not Hazel B. Little launch, anyway. Emma Forrest ran it. And it was quite a... Pickering had a team there in Mayo, anyway, so he took us up to... he and Jimmy Greenfield, his partner, and we stayed up at Discovery the first night and camped around there, and then we went up over the hill, on top of the hill there, and looked around, and it looked very interesting to me that certainly was quite a bit of galena showing on there on the side of the mountain, on the gulch side, towards the McQuestion side. So we took Jimmy Anderson was with us, and Jimmy and I stayed down, went down in the gulch that night and slept under the trees there, and then we went back up, and next day and looked all around, and then Jimmy, he decided he'd have to go down to the Discovery camp too, so I stayed there another night. And this time I looked around a lot of other areas kind of back in there, and I decided I found some galena too, and around on the hill there. And so I staked the, when they came up next day, they all came up, and we staked the Keno claim and a number of other claims there for each one of them. And
had Louis Brevet already staked there?
Yes, Louis had staked his claims.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but he hadn't staked the one, the middle claim there, and he staked that, we staked that a little bit later. He staked it, you know, I laid it out for him. I took a survey instrument with me on the transit there, and made a kind of a plot and did it up that way. And it was kind of, that year was kind of late. There was a big snowbanks along the side of the hill there. So there were some areas we couldn't see. We couldn't see in the area where number 9 day and where this present development is. We were unable to get in there, but we did see scattered mineralization in places. So that we got quite an area tied up there, and Pickering, and I was included in, leased the ground to Yukon Gold Company, and that they formed the company and shipped up an outfit that on the last boat coming up the river, and they got settled down, and Pickering hauled the outfit up as good as out of tents and various equipment, and windlasses and buckets and all the mining tools, powder and everything. We had a, as soon as the hydraulic season shut down in Dawson, Pickering sent one of his old foremen up there with us and some of the boys that worked in hydraulics, and they were good miners because they were using powder all the time all more or less California miners anyway. Bill Danicky was the foreman. And we lived up there and toughed it out all winter. Get about 35 below up on top of the hill. But it was high storms. But I had located the camp under the ridge a kind of bluff, and that kind of broke the south wind, fury of the south wind. And so we just have some, we did very well, but we had not kept no trail open to dog, to mail. I used to go down with a dog and break through there. Somebody might break a track and come up, and we'd get the mail once in a while. That was the first winter of that. We opened up some very, that was the winter of 19 and 1920. The 1919 was the year staking in August 1919. July, I think it was the last day of July, last 2 days of July. And this, we continued on that, to mine that. We took out some pretty good showings. It was a nice showing of lead there in day number three. And then we opened up some of those over on top of the hill, small ones there, 2, 4, and worked down at number 1, 2 a little bit, but it was rather difficult to work down there. And the following spring, you can go up to send in the engineer from Frank Short from San Francisco, and we had a geologist in there, and we made some quite general examinations around. And that was the year that the thing broke open. More people went up and staked, and they found the Wernicke mine. And so we rushed over and got the Sadie right next to it. And we opened that up the following winter after that. And so that was quite a time of pioneering around there. Everybody was building cabins and people coming in. In fact, they had the top of the hill all staked around there. And of course, Andy Johnson had staked over Sourdough Hill there and got all he wanted over there. We never even went over there to look at his ground. But Galena Hill was, of course, seemed like an attractive place. I was always advocating people going over to Galena. In fact, I think I was the first one to call it Galena Hill because I didn't know anything about it, because Galena Creek was over on the far end of it. And I told everybody, I remember an old man, I can't think of his name, go over there. He went over there and he staked some of that ground at the Settlemyer later had, was connected with, and Settlemyer and all those people decided to look over, and they staked all over, and Arthur Stewart came in from the outside. He had been in there for many years. He was an old timer. He had made money down in South America in prospecting, and so he decided to come back to some excitement, and he went over there and staked, and he staked some of that ground. And people from Dawson came up, and Sam Sinyard and all the people that they started. Well, of course, they started to prospect over there, and a little time afterwards, all of them kind of started to connect with some good mineralization. It was a
In fact, you discovered all the major discoveries right there in the first crucial
period. Yes, I think it was, if you said that. They did dug around kind of here there. Well, I came up to Dawson in March 1911 with a gang of hydraulic men from the Yukon Gold Company. Mr. Coffey, George Coffey, was the leader of the gang there, and I went over the White Pass and down the White Horse, And then we drove north in sleighs, and they took about a week. And I remember out towards Tequila there, the road was up and down, and I got seasick in the morning eating breakfast in White Horse, just getting out to Tequila. I can remember diving into those drift holes there in the snowbanks. It was four-horse team, and it was really something new. I guess I was a little bit squeamish from having got seasick across Dixon's Entrance and those kind of places anyway. And then we got into Dawson, and they were in April, and they were working on the dredge, number 9 dredge, I think it was. But I'm not too sure about that, whether they had number 9 there or not. It was near the forks that time, or when they got it the next time. And I got down there and worked up the, saw the old place that they had been handling the gold, and it was very unsatisfactory, the equipment for handling so much gold and the Maryland and so forth. So before I left San Francisco, I bought from Joshua Hendy Ironworks a retort oven, which came in during that summer. And we fixed up the old building and built a little addition on for a furnace room, and built some brick furnace, gasoline brick furnace, and fixed it up. And then we built the retort oven on the back of that later on, and we got all fixed up nicely then to handle large quantities of gold amalgam. Used to bring it in on the with the horse-drawn rigs, and to leave it off there overnight, overnight we kept it there for a week sometimes. We had the buyers ready for each boat that came in from White Horse, and that was when I first went there. The banks and everybody had always made it into little 4-pound bars, small affairs, and sometimes you'd have 100 of those things, you know. Just fantastic, the amount of those things, and you're trying to pour all those bars and strings of molds and the gold flying around there, you know, to get in there and pop, you had to get those molds hot. So I got them very strongly, which had been recommended to do, build larger molds and ship individual cleanups and individual bars, and so that each cleanup had a card, and eventually a lot of those bars were worth $50,000, one cleanup, one bar, and all you could do to lift it around. So we shipped those out, and we didn't have so much robbery troubles then. With mail the other way, where they were shipping it by mail. Well, you see, the Western Express Company came in there, and they used to take it on the boats and handle it as an express. And that was why they would take the larger one. They didn't care whether they didn't want to be in little ones anyway, because there's much more difficulty to handle little ones. And they had the wooden boxes made that they could drop these bars into, and seal them, and screw down the covers and everything, and seal them up, and nobody could hardly get out of them. Just a few bars, you know, maybe a dozen or so bars to a shipment was much nicer. But they're always individual cleanups. We didn't mix the dredges. And that was the old town was much the same as it had been for quite a few years then. That was only about a dozen or so years after the end of the gold rush, but it was, people had gone. They'd sold the claims to the Guggenheims and They were dredging it out, and the Canadian Thondike was running some dredges. They built those large dredges that they used later on in the Klondike Valley. We were dredging Hunker Creek and Bonanza Creek, El Dorado Creek, and a lot of the hills, all the White Channel on the hills was being hydraulic. They built a $10 million pipe, pipe and ditch line to gather the water.
That was one for 12 miles?
12 mile system.
You were there at that time,
were you? No, I was there. They were running then, of course.
Oh, they had that?
Yeah, they had that all running. But they were the hydraulicking was going on. They just started down in Lovett and all the big cuts, you know. When I first went there, they were just a little started on the edge of it. And they melted most of the gold, a great many of those big hydraulic mines. And all the creek bottoms there were all rich, and they brought in buckets of after buckets of amalgam. Wasn't much gold dust, only individual clean-up claims or something. Somebody, they didn't use mercury to clean it, but it made the most satisfactory way of cleaning up. And then the heavy stuff from the clean-ups, they didn't, Grant Henderson, for instance, didn't clean it up, all of it. Well, he'd bring it down in sacks, and we'd treat it, put it into a big tumbling barrel and a little quick and give it another amalgamation period. Use sodium amalgam sometimes. And then we took and put it all together and retarded in the handy retorts. And we used to get a pretty good cleanup. Some of them would be, you know, several hundred thousand at the time. Some of the big bars, 50,000 bars. And of course, particularly the hydraulics, they get cleaned up in the fall, and theirs were generally in large quantity. And it was, we never had any trouble, never had any robbers or anything around there then. I'd be rather thinking it might be more dangerous nowadays. Having all that stuff there. So we had a busy life from 1911 till 1919 when I went up to, staked up at Keno Hill. Especially all during the war, it was kind of depressing bit for during the war times. Only some of the, a lot of people gone from there. And he had the Sophia accident just at the end of the war. So many people were drowned that we knew, and I read a bit about that in Alaskan every once in a while. It's very interesting. Well, I don't know just what else there is about that.
You were going to say something about tell us something about the early days in Duncan Creek.
Oh, yes, I was going to tell you. Well, that that was before my time. I think they staked Duncan Creek maybe in '03 or something around there. The way it happened, people... Swedes, what's the name of those, the mountains right across from Keno there, right, Jacobson, no, whatever. Don't tell them, I can't think anyway, what it is.
Hinton?
No, not Hinton, not Mount Hinton, but this is across, the river right there from the Keno Hill.
Ledoux.
Ledoux, yes, Ledoux, right across that. But anyway, it's the Jacobson or something like that. Some Norwegian name, anyway. Those fellows were in Dawson, and they'd gone up the Stewart and up the
McQuestion and parked a boat down at the Crystal Creek and gone up over the pass there where Keener City is now, and gone made this next creek coming in from the Mount Hinton range. They found quite some good gold in there. There's gold scattered all over the place there, you know, in the rocks, even up on the hills. Remember that piece of rock we had there with the free gold in it there at the camp? That was interesting. But anyway, the glaciers, of course, had messed it up. And but there's a falls there just about the discovery there, and round that there they made some pretty good cleanups, and they kept it quiet amongst themselves. There was the old man and his sons, and they built a water wheel there and a lot of things which I saw later, the remains of them. They were all carefully put together without any nails or anything like that. And they had a cabin that kind of hid up in the creek where nobody would see it when they went by. So they got away with that for 2 or 3 years. Well, then they some of the people, I can't tell you what the names are now, no one do. Guess they were around mail later, always, of course. And they went up there, and they saw this boat. They were pulling up with McQuestion. They saw this boat there tied up, and they suspected that somebody must be up there. They went, trailed up through in there, and they discovered the place. But there was nobody there at the time. And they saw it panned around and so forth, so they hadn't staked it, you see. They were holding it without staking because they thought nobody would ever bother them. Right ahead of Dunkard and Lord knows where in those days, and not many people around, nobody at Mayo or anything like that, and Indians down at Moosehide. So they went, these three fellows, they staked it. Jake Davidson was one of them. He was bent back out of Canada, out in Ontario, and he says that mines out there again. He was a real prospector. And he said there'd be no use of looking around those mountains around there because they're too stratified now, whatever he meant by that. Pickering used to laugh about that, and he wasn't going to waste any time. Well, he went back to Ontario. I guess it was better back there anyway. And the Swede place didn't really amount to too much, but they got some gold out there. Nice. It was better. And then up above there, and it was later mined, hand mining up quite a bit up through there, and people took out some, but they never, on account of the glaciation, it was too messed up with boulders really to be anywhere good. And Duncan Creek, of course, was staked from the head right up Lightning, way up Lightning, and way up that way, and cleared down to the mouth in Mayo Lake. And people flocked in there, everybody to his claim, and they built cabins and brought boilers up and all that. But here the bedrock was 100 feet down and running in water down there, so nobody got down. There's just a few. Who was the old garage man, the Frenchman at Keno there? Gosh, you know, I know him. Can't say. He was telling me about it. He was with some other fellas, and I think Tommy Portlock's father-in-law there was around. He told me about it down in Frank County. Yes, he went down. They sunk a hole. Finally, Al McIntosh was one of the old those three people. Let's say Al McIntosh, and they sunk a 100-some-foot hole and got down off the center of the creek, and they got a very nice streak of pay streak there, and we were just going to start, and they drifted over towards the creek, and flooded themselves out, and they never were able to get down there again. And they tried to put, they got, the government assisted them, and they bought a big pump and two or three boilers around there, and they pumped, they tried to pump it down, but they never could do it because they're handling the whole valley of water. It's not frozen solid anywhere there. So that was about all Duncan Creek did. And there was some little Mojo Watch and an Englishman down at the below the roadhouse there, you know, in the canyon there. They were able to kind of work some in there and get a little money, but there was no money in anything. So Duncan Creek still remains the same. It's it was quite a lot of gold in it, no doubt, but the glaciers came along and flowed over the hills and everywhere from the east and brought iron ore and everything else in there, you know, heavy black sand and all those hot iron out in the mountains.
Well, that shaft, they did get down, they did get pretty good pay on the bottom.
That's what these people said. There was very good time. The Conte, Frank Conte told me about it. He was working at it, and he was a pretty reliable guy. I believe it wasn't made up, but he had been worked over it, of course, at Dublin and all those places, and he was thoroughly conversant with all that sort of thing. And all of them are Dawson miners too, you know. So come on. That was the all of it about Dublin, but of course. At the same time, before that, somebody had found Mr. Hyatt, H-I-G-H-E-T, they spelled it, but somebody told me there was wrong spelling of it because he really was a regular Hyatt man, like they usually see it spelled. And they had staked in there and found pretty good, which was very good there. They took a lot of money out of Hyatt Creek. Different people. Middlecoff used to take pretty good money all the time out there.
They took the dredge too.
Yeah, and they put the dredge up there, but it wasn't bad dredging ground compared to some of it, but it wasn't quite enough to put one dredge on a place like that. It didn't make too much. And then somebody from there had gone over across, they went down Johnson Creek, they'd staked that, and they had staked over on Dublin, Dublin Gulch. That was pretty good too over there, but they never worked him on any heavy scale till Barker came along with the bulldozers, and they worked there quite a while, I noticed. I don't know. I know it's fine that they went up south, so I guess probably wasn't paying as much as... You always hear how good it is, but you don't really know till they move away from it and go to something else. And that was... about the extent, those three creeks. And of course, at Mayo Lake, there's Mayo Lake. All the tributaries on the going into Mayo Lake, the small creeks, all have gold in them. So gold is ground up. The whole country ground up and shoved over there with gravel, and one creek in there, I know in particular, Chambers was running in there, and he ran. I went down there, he drifted in there, and he went in there, and all of a sudden he came around a vertical wall of rock. I don't know whether it might have been a big boulder, but I couldn't tell. Just amazing in that glacial stuff. And he got a little gold in it, but he's always looking for the channel underneath, but I don't know whether there was a channel in those places. The glaciers have been piled over there so much. And surfaces were covered with gold because the water, the gold left on the surface was fine. Over at Hyatt, Minto Lake was another place. The out of Kastner spent quite a bit of money, or at Schuylkill and so forth. They had, I thought they had a nice white channel area there. There was gold everywhere, but when you come to hydraulic, it didn't amount to much. It'd be big chunks of gravel, big blocks of gravel, big three or four houses, you know, in with all messed up with other things. It all slid in there and dragged in there with glaciers and whatnot, and lots of white quartz over in that area. And in fact, all through to the head of the Klondike is a big area of that. And gold everywhere in all the creek bottoms. I was out there to head of the Klondike, land 1930, about I think was. I had a pack horse there, Archie Close's pack horse, and old Jerry Drapo. Oh, Jerry, an old timer. He came in from Arizona. He was a Frenchman from Canada, but he came in by Arizona, and he used to hunt for the Dawson people there for meat, and he's bringing and catch fish up at Klondike and bring them into Dawson. He made more money that way than he could working around the mines there. And I went over with him to look at Red Mountain over there. There's a kind of an area I could see from the top of Lookout. Looked very, very interesting looking area. And there's gold all around there. There was a creek coming down out of that Red Mountain, and he had called it Gem Creek because he had worked over the other side. And gosh, you could get good pans there in the bottom of the creek. So he and George Potter went out there, and they staked that year, and they set up a cabin. So, but they never could find enough to really. There's no bedrock gold, you know. It's all scattered everywhere, chewed up, and all that country between there and the McQuestion is that way. It is all lots of white quartz veins, plenty of white gravel all through there. But no pastries. But of course, up Dublin there was some, they had pastries there. Some of that was pretty good right up around that granite. And nobody ever made any great amount of money because of the difficulties of mining and so forth. And they're still, as you say, work peso companies trying to dig up those veins now. And Jerry had been up there many years before when he was hunting there for the Dawson trade. He used to come up there, and he found a Drapo Creek and a Hobo Creek there up the head of the South Fork, and right on those hills. That's where we went over to that time with the pack horse. And we stopped at his old cabin. He hadn't been over there for quite a few years. He'd been around Mayo and Dawson all the time, but he didn't go over there, out there. He says, I have a gun I'm sure will be in good shape, a rifle there. I hung it up under the eaves of the one of his hunting cabins. So we'll go up that hunting cabin. That was over towards the main Klondike from this Drapo Creek where he was at his cabin. The cabin there was full of squirrels. It messed up things pretty bad, but not too bad. We stayed there a couple of days, three, 4 days, and panned in the creek and everything. He did quite a bit of mining, he and another man, in the early days there. And that was the same proposition. There was gold everywhere, all over the hills and the benches. The benches had gold in them, but not just due to dispersion, due to the glaciation that had knocked the whole thing. If it had been normal cycles of erosion, well, the gold would have got into channels. Could have had pretty good pay streaks, no doubt. And this Red Mountain proved to be, we sampled some of the veins, and it had gold in it all right, but we couldn't carry too many samples back. We didn't have any. Just that old pack horse, which, no, we didn't have the pack horse because He was so ornery, we got rid of him. He let turn him loose, and he went back to Archie. They're from the Klondike. No, it's from the Klondike. To Archie. So we knew we had to walk. We got a boat from George, what's your name? It used to be there. He had a cabin down the mouth of Johnson Creek. I can't think of an old time there anyway. And we pulled up the McQuestion. It was a very nice stream full of great big grayling. All those riffles were covered with grayling. And went up to this creek that turned off towards Red Mountain. And that's the way we got over there to South Fork. And the moose were standing around there looking at it. They hadn't seen anybody. Jerry had left there so many years before that they never didn't know what a white man was. That was a great, great trip I had there. Not a nice country. But that was 1930. We were shut those down, of course. And that's about all the gold. As I say, people mine gold all over the place, way up on the side of the hills, and the gravel has some in it. Maybe someday there'll be enough value to gold to make it pay on some of those poorer prices, but they, at the present time, I don't know.
How about some of the old characters that were up there, you know, Hector
Morrison? Hector came in 93, and he came to there, and he climbed up Hungry Mountain to look around. And he says he was really hungry then, because he did. He got about 5 stewards they were going to go, and they didn't pull any farther. And he went back, but I don't know when Hector came up the next time again, but he was over at the Hyatt. He was worked over on Hyatt. He had some at Hyatt ground later. Those places, Hyatt, I believe, opened up more around in the 90s or something, sometime at the end of the 90s. It was people looking, found that, you know, they were looking for, Jake Davison was one up. They were looking where the gold came, got into all those creeks there, the South Fork of the McQuestion. The North Fork of McQuestion, I mean, was down there, gold everywhere. Joe Watts told me about, he was trying to mine it down there, and he got back in the swamps away from the creek, river down there, you know, a few miles above the confluence with the Stewart River. And he sunk a hole back in there, and by George, he said, there was good gold in there, but it was only a spot. It was just a bar diggings, you know, inland. There's bar diggings all through those flats. the bars, but nobody done too much digging around there. But he found it good, and he was always thinking of the fella who's going to mine, get enough in one of those pots to make it worthwhile. But they put a dredge down at the mouth of a question, and they didn't make anything out of that. Of course, they weren't inexperienced people, and they didn't know what to do. Probably we thought at the time that they wouldn't make anything. It was that sort of a proposition.
Well, Hector, he went on to discover...
And Hector Morrison, he finally came up... he came over from Hyatt, I guess, or wherever his headquarters. I just don't recall. I didn't meet him, you see, the first times I went up there, and I didn't remember just what it was. But Hector came over and looking for a job, you see, with us. When we were up on top of the hill in the springtime, the hydraulic boys had to go back to work down to Dawson, you see, and I had to rustle up crews of the old-timers around there. And I remember Hector was one that I recruited, and he, of course, he was a good worker. And He went, he was hot after me to tell him where to go stake around there because it wasn't quite staked up. Well, I said, damn, I know where to go. It's just a matter of luck. You better trust your own luck there to go. And I told him it looked pretty good over that way outside the where the Lucky Queen was, you know, there. And, pretty fair. And he and Garnet Watt went over there and they staked claims next time. He staked Lucky Queen there.
Garnet Watt,
he staked that other claim on the bench above it, you know. And there wasn't nobody ever took any money out there yet, but they're still always talking about it. Might run, the vein runs through in there, but.
Well, Captain Morrison, he made the discovery on Lucky Queen.
Yeah, sure, he made the discovery. We had it. I leased it from him for $5,000, I think it was. I wrote up a paper where I was taking leases around there from various people. And just we'd take a chance and do some digging there. And of course, meantime they discovered that that vein kind of coming out in the side of the gulch down below there, and it looked a lot of great copper in it, you know, it's kind of good. And but it wasn't a very big thing, but I don't know what it ever amounts to yet. I don't know that nobody ever gone in there yet, too far. Built a cabin down there, Hector did, and he was going to find out about that. So he went up there at the base of the hill and he dug a hole and got a lot of galena in it and ruby silver and so forth. So across the kind of quite a little flat there, bench flat, and the old lake, Glacial Lake shore. So he looked pretty good, and Barnicky came in and he was out that winter and he rushed in there and he gave him $50,000 for that. And which it sounded like a lot of money, but it was about 10 million ounces or so. But Hector, he was didn't need too much to keep it going. Hector was
satisfied with $50,000.
Yeah, he was satisfied. He went out and got married out in Vancouver. Very started a new life. But
he'd be pretty old by then, too.
Well, I forget how old he was, but he was must have been 70 anyway, at least. No, I guess he wasn't. He's right around 70 probably, because he was a good worker in the mines and so. And he did fantastic job there prospecting in that slide during the winter time in the drifting snow. You know, he made some holes down and then got out of bedrock and run into this ore, and everybody was excited all of a sudden. And it was really good. We were down there just scratching our ground there to try to make a go of it by that time, down at the foot of the hill. They had the Sadie opened and everything and mined out kind of the door. Or it didn't seem to go down too far, but it was just maybe an illusion. I don't know how it is around there. Nobody really knows yet about those ore bodies, whether they do go down too far, but they seem to be more persistent than anybody would think for. And that's
another real hard worker around there that I remember was probably Matt Butcher.
Yeah, Matt Butcher. Well, Matt Butcher was an old timer around Mayo, kind of a prospector type of a fellow from Yugoslavia, and he was. He liked to get off himself and dig places, you know. He had been placer mining, of course, probably over at Hyatt, I think. And Matt East came up and staked, same as all of them, all the people around there staked. But he never got, he had a place there open. We bought some ore from him, I remember one time. That was his mill. But still, there's been no great amount of production from that series of veins. It's just beyond the Queen there.
Well, didn't he run a long tunnel in?
Yes, he ran quite a tunnel in there, and he took a bit of ore out of that. And
by hand?
Yeah, hand work, of course, and it was lots of work. And, well, I don't know. He was around the last I heard, but he probably died by now, seems like he might have. He's younger than I was, though. I'm thinking about it, so. Those fellas, and of course there was Axel Erickson. Axel, he staked the up there on top of the flat there, you know. You know the, I can't tell you the name of it now, but you know, right down below our Keener Hill mine there, down towards
Shamrock?
Down there? Shamrock, yes, Shamrock. Shamrock was, he staked that. He was up there same, the next day after we were up there and did their staking. And Axel was an old timer. He'd been down, he was working over at Lookout Mine. The Lookout, Pickering had the Lookout mine running that summer. He'd been running all spring and since the last summer, before 1919. He was running there and they got kind of, they didn't have much to show there. That's the place where Ajo is, isn't now, was prospecting. And they were getting sick of it, and of course Keno put the kibosh on the whole thing. Everybody rushed over to find all these new mines over there and there, and Axel, he staked right next to our ground there. And they had a pretty good showing there. They took quite a lot of ore out of the Shamrock. It was a pretty good mine. The mine, probably maybe it is now for all I know. Nobody ever finished it off because the price of silver went down so low that time, and we closed down and moved away. And when it came back to Galena Hill. And that was the end of the reason for that. Well, he and Tommy McKay, Axel and Tommy McKay were together kind of scouting around there, and they were staking all that fall after 1919, looking for better places and making good ground all over the place. And it was interesting time that way. And I don't know who else. Billy Burrell, he was another resident, actually lived over there at by Crystal Lake. He was kind of disillusioned with the country, but he said there's some interesting things there. I almost was going over there to see him one day. But he worked for us around different mines later. And what was the old fellow's name there at the Mouth of Lightning there? He, he was a Yugoslavian.
Filipovic.
No, not Filipovic, that's another fellow. Gergovic, no, it is something like that. He was there and he was plastering Mouth of Lightning right on the well, Duncan Creek doesn't go any above the Discovery much, and the rest of Lightning Creek, and it's steeper there.
Well, they found Galena veins on Duncan Creek too, didn't
you? Oh yes, I saw those. There was Galena in there. Everybody knew that, and that vein there, and then when it comes in right near the Lucky Swedes there on Discovery, Duncan. Right near their cabin, there was a vein came in there. Somebody dug in there at different times. There was dilutes in it, and they did nothing. As far as I've heard, never any production anywhere yet or done anything. In fact, I don't think they did anything down there in the Flame and Moth claims much yet that I can see. That's the big bottom of one of the big veins off the hill, runs down through the, maybe the Queen Vein.
Yeah.
Goes down through that way. And it runs over and comes out into Duncan too, crosses Duncan too, goes down the valley, she's like. Well, there's no. It's he was a Yugoslavian.
Filipovic.
No, not Filipovic, that's another fellow. Gergovic, no, it is something like that. He was there, and he was plastering the mouth of lightning right on the Duncan Creek. He doesn't go any above the Discovery much, and the rest is Lightning Creek, and it's steeper there.
Well, they found galena veins on Duncan Creek too, didn't they?
Oh yes, I saw those. There was galena in there. Everybody knew that, and that vein there, and then when it comes in right near the lucky Swedes there on Discovery Duncan, too, right near their cabin, there was a vein came in there. Somebody dug in there at different times. There was dilute in it, and. I've heard never any production anywhere yet or done anything. In fact, I don't think they did anything down there in the flame and moss claims much yet that I can see. That's the big bottom of one of the big veins off the hill runs down through the maybe the Queen Bay.
Yeah.
Goes down through that way. And it runs over and comes out into Duncan too, crosses Duncan and goes down the valley, she's like. Well, there's nobody has done anything with those I know of, as I've heard of.
Well, old Sandy McPherson and Alverson were...
Yeah, Alverson was there, and Sandy McPherson, now they were... they knew, of course, the Tom Aiken's place there, and they worked there, you see, and Alverson had an exclaim to it, but he never got down, he cut across there, but he never got down to a bedrock, you know, and made that discovery until the time that after we'd taken the lead, about the time we got there, and up to that time, when he leased the place.
Was leased from
Hawthorne. Yeah, he leased from Hawthorne. He had the gumption enough to dig in the hole, dig in the ditch that Alverson had made, and they found a vein down in that ridge. And that was a real nice vein, about 700 feet long, and very rich and nice for a level or two. And then there was nothing underneath it, seemed like. As far as we could, a certain level didn't amount too much. And of course, the price still went down. Wernicke abandoned that setup because he didn't own it and he wanted so much for it. And that was the story when we opened up over there.
Well, who actually discovered the Sadie and Ledoux? Who were they?
The Sadie and Ledoux? Oh, the Sadie was, the Ledoux was Stewart. Stewart, you know, Arthur Stewart is his name. He was a fellow that had been in there in the early days, made a lot of money over Klondike there way, and I made some money over there enough, so he went outside and then he went down to South America and was around Peru a long time. And he made money all those places. So he was had a family and kept going. He heard about the Stewart. He'd been up there in the early days, the Stewart. And remember, so he... Well, let's see, what were we reviewing at that point?
We're talking about... Ledoux and Sadie.
Oh, yes, Ledoux and...
What is this person name?
Stewart. He was Arthur Stewart, I think was his name. But anyway, it's Stewart. He and another old fellow from Dawson, an old-time teamster down Dawson, that would made us some money and was well fixed too, and they were kind of teamed up together. I can't tell you his name, the other fellow, but Stewart was, they lived there, they fixed up a cabin right there near Discovery and stayed there for a while. And he asked me where to go stake, and I told him different places that I knew hadn't been staked. And they staked up quite a bit of ground on the top of Galena Hill there and around. And then they went over there and staked over at the Wernicke camp there, that the new place there. And then they found there was something there, too, accidentally. I was almost down there one day on top of the hill a year or so earlier. And I looked down there from the bench, and I just said, I couldn't have time enough to get down and get back before supper. And it was an interesting country around there. I walked around the Lucky Queen, but of course you couldn't see anything. And we were then a young fellow, old timer, some odd around there. He and his wife were working at the hotel, Burnett's Hotel. He was up there, and he staked the next claim to it, the Sadie. And I can't think of their names, but it doesn't matter. And he was kind of a barroom hanging around fella, and all those. Wife was a good worker. She worked in the restaurant part, and they did quite a business. And he enjoyed his money he got out of that. I've forgotten the sum now. It was a good big sum. And kind of that was a Yukon Gold Company, or the Keenan Hill Limited bought that.
They bought the
same. Yeah, they bought
where
the same.
Bought the...
Yeah, bought the other. I was... Frank Short and I were there looking over this place there, what they dug out, and thinking it over, and Wernicke was over there buying the other place. Same time we're there, and Halster, I guess it was, Hector, no, Stewart, anyway, came over, and he told us what Wernicke was offering for that other, and we said they can't, we're not going to go in that deep, that's too much, it was hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, for that property. What we'd seen on it, it looked kind of good, but I didn't think it was that good. We just stuck with the Sadie. Frank Short had been down May on at least the Sadie off of this fella that was working for that. So that was the extent of that. We went over there and started prospecting. In the winter of 23, we sunk a shaft in it there and drifted and found it pretty good, but a lot of water in it, and it had to pump it. I laid out a power line over from the other one, our top of the hill power line, and we worked it. But it was expensive working that way. So after finding out what to do, I made a good lease with Wernicke to work it out, and that brought in quite a bunch of money on that. So that was that part of the country.
Well, Jack Oliverson, he...
Jack never really had anything except that claim, and he had sold it to the mining recorder down at Mayo there then. You see that next to the Silver King.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Jack ever got any piece of money, really.
Jack Crawford is the one who got the money.
Jack, yeah, he leased it, then he sold his lease, you see, at Wernicke.
Mm-hmm. Hawthorne had a lease, is that all he had?
Yeah, well, I suppose a lease was purchase arrangements or something, you know.
From
whom?
Huh?
The man that was the recorder there, you know, an old-timer storekeeper in Mayo. You know, I can't say people's names right off now. He was a recorder there before the Silver King was opened up.
Oh, I see. Well, in other words, who owned it first, Jack Oliverson?
Jack had staked alongside the Silver King one time. Yeah. You see, the Silver King wasn't staked by, Tom Akin.
Yeah.
Tom Akin, he leased it from this fella, I can't say his name now. Not looking it up, but he was a fellow, Harry McWhorter.
Yeah.
Harry McWhorter. He wasn't really the discoverer of it because various people saw this vein crossing the canyon naturally there, and they dug into it, see a little galena in it, and what's that around here? They couldn't nobody make any money of that sort of stuff. They were looking for gold. First thing, everybody was, Duncan Creek opened up, everybody was panning every gulch there, any place they thought there was bedrock or something that they could pan. And of course they all saw this there. But McWhorter went outside and was in eastern Canada there, and there was lots of mining booms going on. He got to thinking about 1911 or so. I think it was 11. He came up there and would go up there, he'd go to stake that vein there, go up there and assay it. He did. He found it was at high value. Of course, it was very high grade there, 300 ounces, I think. And so he got Tom Aiken, was an old driving dredge man, somebody he knew there, around there. It was down the river at that time. And he came up, back up. He'd been down in Iditarod. He made a lot of money down in Iditarod or somewhere. And so Harry leased it to him, and he did the mining for 2 years and took out some good piece of stuff. But it was pretty tough operation, high cost, very pioneering, no road or anything over there. So that was the end of the Silver King. Stood around there for 2, 3, 4 years. I was over there, as I say, in 1980 and 1780 in winter, to see, looking around, and went with Jack Alverson over to Ledoux Range there, and the Ledoux Range. Davidson Mountain, they call them too. That was the name of those Swedes there that were on the Duncan there, Discovery Duncan. And but there were people prospecting around. Axel Ericsson and another young Swede were digging down the mouth of Crystal Creek when that same time, that winter. We went around and visited him. And he had some nice ore there, nice pieces, but they weren't in place. They had that Formo. It was just below the Formo operations out there on that end of the hill. You don't sit that. They opened up quite a bit and took some more out there. And they still, I think, are going to start. The company's going out there now. I think they own that.
Mm-hmm.
They bought it. And I don't... that's about the early history of the thing. It was a very expensive place to operate. It cost a lot of money to haul the ore down from there, and Picking didn't make anything out either. And they couldn't. They needed a mill there to get the values out, and a lot of it.
Well, what did Jack Hawthorne and Ruth Ferguson, what did they get out of that? $300,000, wasn't it?
Well, they got a good pay. I don't know. I don't know how much Jack got or how much she got. I don't know what happened to the money, but where is Jack now, do you hear?
Still up there, I think.
Is he? He was worker, yeah, a worker, a good guy. I liked him, you know, but of course he was crazy with a lady there, friend. And she was, I guess, good for him. I think she held him down to keep him going, you know, and kept him.
Well, I heard that she was still, you know, giving him, because he spent all his.
Oh, yeah, I expect so.
You know, he was giving him enough to get bacon and beans.
Yeah, that'd be about the size of it, I'm sure. I think he had spent it all when we left. He couldn't, he had no training for that sort of thing. Keep his money, but he was a good worker and he had a pretty good head on him for prospecting, you know. Anyway, he was lucky. And And I don't know what else. Maybe shut off and say.
Well, we were going to talk about Livingston Wernicke. He came in there in 1921, I think. And his boss, and he had been in there before we struck Keno Hill. But they didn't know about it, and they went out that fall. So they came back. Yeah, I think they came back in 21. Not 20, but I'm not. I think it was 21, yeah. Anyway, he started buying that property, and he bought the property over there, and he took. Yeah, the Ledoux property, and next to the Sadie. And so he was around there for all those years till about 1941, I think it was, he killed. And did a lot of prospecting in the Yukon with Plains, first man to do that. But his unfortunate times, the war came on, and really kind of put the stoppers on all of that. He was he had worked for the Treadwell Yukon and across the channel there, the one that flooded out. He was in there when they were being flooded there. He was working there, and before that time he was on the railway up to copper mines at Kennecott there, and he and Mrs. Wernicke arrived in '06, and went up there to live. He graduated from the University of Washington, so that was about his history. He worked, of course, a long time at Juneau there, and was a geologist there, and did a lot of underground exploration on it, and outside exploration for them. And of course, they took over Keno Hill. Keno Hill was the new property, and started in from there.
You have no idea. Eventually absorbed all.
I've forgotten, it's several hundred thousand. Stewart got a good bunch of money out of that. Yeah, really good money. He had split up with his partner was the other fellow there that I told you about, the Teamster from Dawson. It was big money anyway. He really got the money. And that was where he got really started. Otherwise, he'd looking around. I used to come up to camp once in a while there, and I visited with him on top of the hill at dinner. And he was, didn't know about it. He looked at Silver Basin and all those other places, but he didn't look like a place he could start in on. But when Stewart found that down there, digging on that ground right after the snow went off, Wernicke was right there on the ground, you see, and he saw that right away. And we heard about it almost simultaneously, and Frank dashed down and got the Sadie nailed down before the Sadie man knew too much about it either, you see. That's why we have to get on the Sadie, and had a good ore body in there. Well, that's that then.